Welcome to the John Chapman Show, where we talk about the path of a wealthy millennial, uncovering the truth about building and protecting your nest egg. Join us on this journey as we hear the stories of millennials and mentors alike to help you plan, manage, and protect your wealth. John is an employee of WorthPoint LLC. All opinions expressed by John and podcast guests are solely their own opinion and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of WorthPoint. This podcast should not be relied upon for investment decisions and is for informational purposes only.
Hey, Vijay, thanks for joining the podcast today. How are you doing, man?
Yeah, doing well. It's a gorgeous day in San Francisco. Happy to be on, man. Good to see you. Yeah,
it should be fall time, but it feels like summer up there, doesn't it?
It's literally 90 degrees in San Francisco, and I can't remember. So I grew up here, but the last time it was 90 degrees when I was actually here. You know, it's happened like two or three times this summer.
Hey, that's the price we pay for being Californians, I guess, of having gorgeous weather.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
got a nice tan going, which is nice.
That's great. I was looking forward to talking about options, both incentive stock options and non-qualified stock options, specifically because there seems to be still just so much going on in the world of private startups. And for me, I'm dealing with clients that are coming to me with paperwork saying, I have no idea what I own. I don't know when it vests. I don't know the taxes that I pay. And so there's so many conversations around this that my hope is we can give a small introduction to the two different forms of options and explain a few basics like, you know, the grant date, the vesting, and the exercising, and a little bit of the tax consequences. So remind us again for the listeners, tell us a little bit about your background very briefly and the company that you work for.
Absolutely. So I spent 5 years at PricewaterhouseCoopers in the tax group, where I specialized in tax compliance and consulting for hedge funds and private equity funds. Did that for about 2 years. In my last 3 years, I was in consulting group where we helped set up the tax functions for startup hedge funds and private equity funds. So great experience, but decided to go back to my roots and my interest in tech. And started working for a fintech startup called SecFi. Okay. I'm the head of tax advisory here, where I spend a lot of my day speaking to clients, employees of private companies that have stock options and need help with them. So I do that, you know, pretty much 90% of my day, just helping employees with their stock options, finding solutions for them so they can exercise their options.
That's great. Do you mind telling a little bit more about that? So if you're talking to an employee that need helps with their options, what are some of the things that they would come to you needing help with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like you mentioned, it's just understanding stock options. I think it's such an esoteric subject. And I think a lot of people very much, especially in the tech world, that, you know, they don't have a financial background. They may be engineers, really smart people, but they just know they don't teach this stuff in school, right? So they get their first job out of school. They started, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, they started working for a great company, maybe an Uber type company, and they were granted stock options. And literally what they thought was the best way to do it is, this is a future problem. You know, let's hold this off and figure it out down the road. And when time comes 4 or 5 years later and everyone starts talking, saying the magic word, IPO, you know, people start freaking out and trying to find solutions on how to solve this problem where a lot of people have these insane amount of stock options where you could pay a dollar to go get something that's worth $20. It's a no-brainer. But when you're looking at, you know, hundreds of thousands of options, not a lot of people has that, you know, liquidity sitting in their bank account, hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay the company for stock. And not only that, you have this gigantic tax bill, which I'm sure we'll get into later on.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it presents a lot of problems, and it's obvious, you know, for employees, and again, dealing with people that both of us had, you know, the main goal is to do a really good job at your job. And so staying on your grind and focusing on that is naturally like the focus of attention. But all of a sudden, you know, life happens, either you getting let go or choosing to leave after a few years, or some big major event like an acquisition or an IPO, like a big exit. That brings up some of these major life events. Let's start by just talking about kind of framing out from the very top two different kinds of options. There's ISOs and NSOs. Can you give us just a brief summary of either option?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's really two, like you mentioned, two types of options, incentive stock options or ISOs and non-qualified stock options or NSOs. Really, the tax code defines them as, you know, the tax code only defines incentive stock options. You're either an incentive stock option or you're an NSO. Yeah. And really, the difference between the two is that ISOs typically carry a significant tax benefit.
Yeah.
So with ISOs, you, generally speaking, you know, not always the case, but you typically want ISOs if possible. With that said, there's limits on how many ISOs you can get. And quite often, you know, people will have both ISOs and NSOs and not know the difference between the two.
That's great. Is there a time frame? What would be the psychology or the methodology for a private business to offer ISOs versus NSOs? Like, what would a situation be or a scenario for an employee to maybe be offered both?
Yeah, absolutely. So typically, there's an 100 grand ISO limit, right? How much you can offer. So typically, when you're looking at an early stage company, you know, it's a seed funded or Series A private company or startup, you know, pretty much everyone gets ISOs. They carry tax benefits. You know, one thing to note, only available to U.S. employees. So there's no such thing as an ISO for Canadians or Europeans or anything like that.
Right.
So, you know, typically when you're an early stage employee, you're granted ISOs. As the company matures, you know, the value of that stock.
Yes.
If it goes right, you know, goes skyrockets and it gets a little expensive.
Right.
You know, one share can be worth, instead of the pennies you get it for at the early stage, it can be worth $20, $30, $40, $50, if not more. And then, you know, there's that 100 grand limit. So you get to that 100 grand limit pretty quickly.
Right.
So typically, okay. Some private companies just say, okay, no more ISOs. Everyone's just getting NSOs. We don't want to deal with the administrative burden.
You're right.
And then there's the whole world of, you know, they want to start giving restricted stock units as well. But, you know, sure. That's for another day.
I guess that's for another day. Let's pick on ISOs for a few minutes and talk about those specifically. And maybe we can come back to NSOs in just a couple of minutes. So for a company, a private company that's either initial seed or series A, B, or C, let's just use that as our framing example. Explain to us some of the different milestones in this process. So there's going to be an initial grant of some number of shares, and then there's going to be a vesting schedule timeframes, and then eventually the ability to exercise. So walk us through some of the timeframes for the employees.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just use an example, right? Let's say, John, you take a job at a company called Pied Piper. They just got their seed round. I'm rewatching episodes. It's great, by the way. Silicon Valley. If you haven't seen it, it's great. Anyways, you start working for a Pied Piper. As far as negotiation, they tell you, as most startups say, hey, we cannot pay you what you're typically used to getting at your skill level, but we're going to make up for that by giving you stock in a company, because down the road, hopefully the stock is going to be worth a lot and you'll make up for the pay cut that you'll take.
Sure.
That's generally, you know, the logic behind stock options. And you want to incentivize employees to go have skin in the game, if you will. You know,
of course.
You're going to be a member of the company.
That's great.
So when you join the company, you're negotiating with the company. They'll give you your salary plus a stock grant, right? So let's say you're granted 10,000 options to buy one stock, 10,000 options to buy 10,000 shares of Pied Piper for a dollar. That's the grant date. You're granted that, and at that moment, that locks in the grant date. That's the date you receive the option. There's another date called the vesting date, right, associated with the grant, where the vesting date means when you actually own that option. And what I mean by that is, let's say, the typical vesting schedule is it's a one-year cliff. What I mean by that is, in 25% of your options, so 2,500 options at this point, 1 year from the grant date becomes available to you, so you can start exercising them. So in 1 year from the grant date, you can exercise 2,500 options for $1. You can pay your company $2,500 to own 2,500 shares of the company.
Yep. Okay, that's good. And then, so typically there's a 1 year cliff, and then what is it, maybe 4 years after that. So how do the rest of the shares become vested to you, under what circumstance or what time frames?
Yeah, and I say this is typical, but it's not a rule. It's not like an IRS rule. It's typically a 1 year cliff, so 25% vest on that 1 year anniversary. And then thereafter, Every single month, you'll have a small portion of that over the course of 4 years. That's very common. I'd say 95% of the companies we work with have that vesting schedule. So the idea is every single month, you have more options that vest. And after 4 years, so 4 years from my grant date, you'll be 100% vested. You can exercise all 10,000 options for $10,000 at that $1 grant price.
What's the typical time frame that somebody has to exercise? So from the time of the grant, there's a vesting schedule naturally, but at what point, if they don't take action, is there some term limit on the exercisability?
Yeah, so typically, and when I say typically, 95, I'm going to give the 95% example because there's always exceptions, always companies that do different things. But you have your entire employment time to do this. You can exercise as soon as it vests. You can exercise right then and there, or you can hold on to it and wait. The key factor is typically when you leave a company, you have 90 days to exercise or your options expire completely. And what I mean by that is you can, if you don't pay the company $10,000 for those 10,000 shares, you'll lose that all after 90 days after you've left your position at the company.
Okay. Yeah, that's a really important thing. And note out there for people that have either changed jobs or are thinking about changing jobs, that 90-day window is closing fast. And so that's a really important, and oftentimes people don't even realize that exists. So that's just a
super absolutely
mindful.
The amount of calls I get from people who they reach out to me, it's like, hey, I have 3 days to exercise. Can you help? You know, it happens so much more than I'd like.
Yeah,
that's and it's one of these situations where I'm like, you need to be talking to a wealth advisor. This could be a large part of your wealth. You know, you're giving it up at this point.
Yeah.
So it's a very difficult situation. And, you know, you got to plan ahead. That's the biggest factor.
One notable story I have too, one of my first experiences with this probably 4 or 5 years ago, that exact thing happened. I had an executive that I'd been working with a little bit on and off, but he was so busy I didn't get time to, you know, talk to him. And I remember on December 1st, towards the end of the year, he's like, hey, I just resigned. And I just about fell over because I knew that 90 day rule. And so thankfully we were right on the calendar year end. So we took some action, but man, that, that really woke me up. So anyway, so let's talk about some of the tax implications. Are there any taxes at the time of the grant or the time of the vest?
Yeah. So for ISOs or any stock options, you are taxed when you exercise for the U.S., right? Different countries have different rules, and that's important to realize. But for U.S. tax purposes, when you're granted the option, you do not get taxed. When the options vest, you do not get taxed. But when you exercise your options, let's say I decide after 1 year, I decide to exercise 2,500 my options. I'll write the company a check for $2,500 for 2,500 shares because it's a $1 strike price. I'll get taxed at that moment. I'll get taxed on the difference between that $1 strike price, right? The strike price is given to you at your grant date, which is $1 locked in the situation. And the difference between that $1 and what the company is worth or the 409A price. So every single year, just to explain this concept a little more, I think it's a little foreign to some people. Every single year, the private company is required to get an appraisal called a 409A price. Effectively, that's just saying how much each share is worth in the company. So you had one, at the time you were granted your options, the company was worth $1 per share. After 1 year cliff, let's say the company went up to $2 per share. So you'll pay a tax on that difference between the $2 and that $1. So you'll pay $1 per share to the company, then you'll pay the U.S. government the difference of $2 over $1 added to your taxable income, effectively.
Yeah, that's right. And so there are some uniquenesses there too. We were not going to get into it really on this show because that's for, you know, maybe someone like a CPA or a tax expert. So, but maybe you can explain how ISO's tax is different from an A&T standpoint, maybe versus now we can compare and contrast to NSOs.
Yeah, absolutely. So mechanically, ISOs and NSOs function the same way. Grant date, vesting date. The key difference, as I mentioned earlier, is the tax situation, right? So just to make things easy, an NSO gets taxed as regular income. That $2, that the fair market value of 409A and the $1 strike price, the difference between the two, that $1 per share for an NSO just gets added to your ordinary income. It's as if you had a $1 bonus multiplied by the amount of shares that you had. It gets added to your wages, essentially. So pretty simple in that idea, right? It's like, it's almost like saying I have an extra bonus that I need to get taxed on. Where it gets a little more complicated is ISOs. And when I mention ISOs have a tax benefit, is because for regular tax purposes, ISOs are not taxed. So you do not add that $1 to your ordinary income. It actually doesn't show up on your regular tax calculation. But there's something called alternative minimum tax.
Yes.
So just to introduce this idea, the alternative minimum tax, the analogy I always give is the regular tax code is a sinking ship with a lot of holes, loopholes. The AMT was enacted by Congress a few years ago to effectively patch up that ship, right?
Yes.
And the idea behind it is you're being too sneaky, getting away with paying little as little tax as possible because you're good at the whole, you know, avoiding tax, idea. Then we're going to enact a second tax to come and get you. And that's really what the AMT is. It's a patch
on
the
good way to put it.
Afloat. Still sinking, and eventually, we'll get into this on a different day, but, you know, better idea to probably just blow up the boat and fix and build a new boat. But, the AMT is there to fix it. So,
yeah, that's right.
For ISO purposes, the AMT effectively attacks the ISO. That $1 gets added to your alternative minimum tax calculation. So it's not as bad as, you know, adding a $1 to your wages, but you will get taxed from an AMT perspective. And there's always this little gap where, you know, it's going to be less of a tax than an ordinary income side. But at the same time, it can still be pretty high considering how much of a difference that 409A is to your strike price.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that's a really important thing. Let's do an example of if your grant price is then far different from what the 409A is. Let's say 5 years has gone by and you were initially granted at $1, but let's say in the future, maybe it's $8 is what the 409A is after that 5 years, just using this as pure examples so we can explain the dollar.
Yeah.
So, normal ISOs, you would typically not have to pay the ordinary income taxes on the spread, but where they do come after you is for AMT purposes. So walk us through an example when the spread is so much greater, you know, at some time to exercise.
Absolutely. So this is the golden problem, right? On paper, right? Let's say you had one, you could pay $1 to go get something that's worth $7. Or maybe even more, right? The 409A typically is a fair market value, but at the end of the day, it's not a true fair market value. I guarantee more people will be willing to pay more than $7 for it. But for all, you know, intents and purposes, let's assume $7. John, would you pay $1 to get $7?
Right, exactly.
Yes. Very simple example. Yes, you would.
Yeah.
But the problem is, right, you're going to owe tax on that difference between, you know, the $7 and that $1. You're going to owe tax on that $6. And when you think about it, right, depending on how many shares you have, let's say you have 10,000 shares, 10,000 options. That $6 difference times 10,000, that's $60,000 that potentially gets added to your AMT calculation. And that is a significant amount. If you think about the AMT, just isolating just the federal side, it can be 26%, 28%. Obviously, the calculation is a lot more complicated. But let's just, you know, we'll use 25% of it, and that's like a $15,000 additional tax, right?
Right.
Think about $15,000 on top of your exercise cost. So not only do you have to pay the thousands of dollars to the company, you're going to owe the U.S. government potentially a lot more as well. And that's the problem a lot of people have. They don't have that cash to exercise and pay their taxes, so they do nothing with them until they have to do something with it when they leave the company or, you know, right before the company goes public.
Yeah. So this is a uniqueness of the challenge of ISOs. Obviously, there's a lot of opportunities, but certainly not without some of these big pits. So we've talked a little bit offline about this idea of early exercise. So just to make sure that we put a bow on part of this ISO conversation, remind us again why the idea of an early exercise, obviously this doesn't come without its risks, no doubt. And so I don't want to give this as advice, but explain again, because of the example we were just using, why is early exercise something to strongly consider after your initial vest date?
Yeah. So I think just to clear the air here, I think there's early exercising and exercising early. I think in that previous example, like let's say Let's say you exercise 1 year after your grant date, right? You can exercise 2,500 options and your shares are only worth $2 at that time. $1 per share tax hit isn't as bad as a $6 per share tax hit, right? So the idea is if you believe in your company, you want to exercise it as early as possible because it's going to continue to go up, right? The company grows, that 498 price can go up. So you can exercise right when you vest. And pay less tax as long as the company keeps on increasing, right? The value of the company keeps on increasing. Now, there's a concept of early exercise. And the concept of early exercise is effectively saying, if the company allows, you can exercise your options before they vest. So in that example, you're granted 10,000 options of Pied Piper. You can pay $10,000 to exercise your 10,000 shares at $1. If the company allows early exercise, you can say, hey, I believe in this company. I'm going to pay $10,000 to the company today on the grant date or whenever. With the idea that before these options vest, I'll pay ahead of time. And if I pay ahead of time, what's the reason why you do that? For tax benefits, right? The value of your shares is $1 now. It's going to be $7 that you know in the future, whatever that number is. So I'm going to pay tax on $1. I got options that are worth $1. The 498 is $1. $1 minus one is zero, right? So you can early exercise and effectively not pay any tax today. But like you mentioned, there is risk to it, right? We don't know as much as we want Pied Piper to succeed, we believe in ourselves, we believe in the company. It can be a significant tax burden. I mean, not tax burden, but a significant liquidity burden on the individual.
Because there's no guarantee that you'll have any type of exit in the future. It could take years or decades or can fold altogether. So obviously that comes with some risk if you're going to pony up some money ahead of time to then, buy those shares or exercise, right?
Right. Absolutely. So it's a great strategy for tax purposes, but tax is just one aspect. There's the whole other side. How much can you afford to lose? Because it's an illiquid investment, right? So a lot of these companies are private longer, and it's not like you can get up and just go into Robinhood app and sell it.
That's exactly right. That's a great point. And so one final thing about the uniqueness of the ISOs, let's pretend that somebody has exercised whenever that has been, either after it's formally an early exercise before they vest, or maybe they've vested and they've waited 5 years, whatever that case is. Let's say they ponied up the cash, they actually bought the shares and they paid the AMT tax bill. What are the other things for them to think about after, more time goes on with the tax implications?
Yeah, absolutely. So why the AMT is unique, it's an acceleration of your tax. So let's say I exercise in year four, exercise 10,000 options. I paid an AMT of, let's say, $20,000, right? I'm just going to make up a number here. So that extra $20,000 in taxes actually becomes a tax credit that you can take in the future years associated with the exercise or ISOs. So let's say in year five, you don't exercise any more ISOs, you're just paying regular tax. You can take a portion of that $20,000 to offset your regular tax. So effectively, you paid a lot of the tax ahead of time, and you're going to start to recover that slowly, piece by piece. And then when you finally can sell your shares, you'll likely recover a large part of that $20,000 down the road. So it's more of an acceleration. It's not an additional tax. But ultimately, the ultimate tax benefit is, if everything goes well and the company does well, effectively what happens is in the future, you get to sell your options or your options for all long-term capital gain. Anything that you sell it for north of that $1 gets preferential tax treatment. So you sell for long-term capital gains, which the highest rate is 20% from the federal side. You compare that to the highest ordinary income rate of 37%. So there's definitely a significant difference there.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And we're in some ways talking about a Goldilocks scenario. If your exercise, while the 409A is lower compared to what it could be in the future, and then be available to have the long-term capital gains from the time of actually exercise to whatever the exit is. But still, that's some things for employees to be thinking about. This is a scenario of what it could be like if the stars aligned And from a tax standpoint, that'd be pretty exciting. So with the time that we have allotted left, let's just really quick talk about NSOs and the differences between the time that they vest and then some of the exercising. So walk through us again very briefly with the NSOs and maybe compare that to the time frame of, let's start with, is something like early exercise available for an NSO?
Yeah, absolutely. So very similar to an ISO in that the date of the grant is still the same. Vesting schedule is still the same. But yeah, there is an early exercise option for NSOs as well. You can early exercise your NSOs, and it functions very similar to an NSO. The key difference with an NSO is you get taxed differently. Instead of getting taxed by the alternative minimum tax, you get taxed. That difference between the 409A and your strike price gets added to your ordinary income calculation. So that's the major, major difference. On the other side, too, when you sell it on the ultimate end, it doesn't carry the same tax benefits as ISOs. And we just mentioned that on ISOs, the idea behind it is if you hold onto it for 2 years after grant and 1 year after exercising, you convert all that gain to long-term capital gain. For an NSO, you don't get that luxury. So what will happen is you'll pay the $1 strike price. You'll pay up to that 409A price, the difference between that 409A and strike price in ordinary income tax. Let's just say the $7 example. So you pay $6 ordinary income tax. And then anything north of that $7 gets taxed as capital gains. If you hold it, let's say you sell it for $10 after holding it for a year or a year or greater, then that $3 becomes long-term capital gains. Compare that to the ISO example, where that the entire $9 becomes long-term capital gain. So effectively, the major difference is you get taxed on a larger portion of ordinary income, and you don't get the benefits of converting everything to long-term capital gain when you sell it.
Yeah, really important. And I appreciate you bringing that down and comparing and contrasting the two. So let's recap a couple of things. So for employees that are listening, they're at a company, and let's just say they've recently started, or maybe the company is starting to go through their granting of the options. What is it, if anything, that an employee needs to do when they first get granted ISOs or NSOs?
Absolutely. So the first thing is plan ahead. Talk to people. Educate. If you want to educate yourself, talk to an advisor, please. Like I always tell people, I've talked to hundreds of people with stock options over the last year. I've been at SecFi. I always tell people the worst thing you can absolutely do is not do anything. You know, and if the outcome is you look at, you study your grants, you talk to an advisor, and the choice is just to not exercise, that's okay. That's a risk, you know, that not a risk, but that's the decision you make, but at least you thought about it. So the first thing you do, in my opinion, is make sure that you're making a plan for this. What's your plan? What do you think how do you think the company's gonna perform? And really that's, you know, I know it's very difficult for anyone to make, but you also gotta consider the facts of early exercise, right? And think if you have that benefit of early exercising, do you early exercise or not? And a lot of people forget that. They just get the grants and they think, okay, I don't want to exercise now because I can exercise next year or still cheap or whatever. But they have this option to early exercise and effectively eliminate any exercise costs down the road. And I think that's something you have to consider at least at that moment, because the longer you wait, the benefits of early exercise kind of go out the window. Yeah. So that's something you do immediately. If you have the option, consider an early exercise. And then the second piece, like I mentioned, start planning for your options. Create an exercise plan for you and your family, and how do you think that you're going to work with this? And if the decision is to hold on to the option until, you know, that the company is getting close to an IPO or not, that's fine. But just plan for any contingencies as well. You know, companies, startup companies are volatile. People get laid off. You know, people decide to leave and chase other amazing opportunities out there. So have a contingency plan for how you're going to handle this, because it could be a large part of your network eventually down the road.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I think there's so many possibilities that can come up. We've really talked just specifically on the options, but obviously employees are dealing with needing to, you know, find a mentor or climb the corporate ladder and think about other roles. And they're thinking about maybe moving to places all throughout the country. So obviously there could be a lot that an employee is facing at this moment, but it's so important. Like you said, got to plan ahead, know the vesting timeframes for, well, I guess really know if early exercise is an option, then know the vesting timeframes, coordinate with a tax advisor so you know all the potential tax implications, and then start really thinking critically, like, how are you going to design your life with this potential money? And that's an important thing. And it takes a lot of introspection to do that. And it doesn't happen overnight, obviously, but it's a really critical moment and can come with lots of risks, but also some fun opportunities. So Vijay, thanks for talking with us today. This has been fun to nerd out on options. We really appreciate your expertise.
Absolutely. Thanks, John. It was fun.
All right. Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to The John Chapman Show. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify. We encourage your questions, comments, and feedback. For additional information, check out thejohnchapmanshow.com or look for John on LinkedIn and Twitter. See you next week.